For Ronald Reagan, 1985 was marked by dealings with an increasingly independent Congress. His limited economic sanctions against South Africa's system of apartheid were needed to head off even more stringent measures from Congress. And protectionist measures on Capitol Hill pushed the president to announce measures of his own to combat unfair trade practices.
It is wrong for the American worker and American businessman to continue to bear the burden imposed by those who abuse the world trading system.
But Congress wasn't satisfied and sent him a bill to cut imports of shoes, textiles, and copper. He vetoed the bill. It took every bit of presidential arm-twisting and pressure that Mr. Reagan could bring to bear to get action on tax reform, the main issue on his domestic policy agenda. The White House worked with the democratically controlled House Ways and Means Committee to produce a tax reform bill, and Mr. Reagan called for action.
As for America's fair share tax plan, we're shooting for Christmas time. Economic growth and tax fairness are gifts we owe ourselves and our children.
But House Republicans, claiming that they'd been left out of the tax reform process, blocked consideration of the bill. And it took a rare personal visit by the president to Capitol Hill to get the Republican votes he needed to get tax reform through the House. Mr. Reagan had a little easier time passing the controversial Graham-Rudman-Hullings bill to force phased reductions in the federal deficit over the next 5 years. Although he campaigned hard in public for the bill's passage, he signed it into law in private, warning of substantial program cuts in the new year. As 1985 drew to a close, an Oklahoma congressman filed suit, charging that the Graham-Rudman bill is unconstitutional. This is Bill Small at the White House.
1985 was the year that acquired immune deficiency syndrome stopped being the gay plague. The overwhelming majority of AIDS patients remain gay men, but this was the year many Americans realized that AIDS didn't strike strangers. It could strike their friends, their neighbors, their heroes.
Mr. Rock Hudson has acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
I think it really hit home, not just to the entertainment industry, but to all of America, because rock is a household word.
Elizabeth Taylor organized an emotional, star-studded benefit to help fund AIDS research. But back in the glare of daylight, away from the glare of stage lights, some agonizing questions remained. AIDS, or the fear of AIDS, entered our schools, where parents fought to keep infected children home. It entered the military, which announced it would start testing personnel. It even entered Hollywood, where some actresses reportedly refused to do love scenes with gay actors. And it started to creep up the priority list of local and federal government. Here's Wisconsin State Representative Dave Clarenbach.
There are two epidemics sweeping our country. One is the AIDS virus itself and the communicable disease that it represents, but also an hysteria and fear among the general public about what that AIDS epidemic means.
The search for a cure goes on, but as things stand now, it seems clear the AIDS crisis is going to get a lot worse before it gets better. Vicki Barker, Washington.
1985 suffered through five plane crashes with death tolls in the hundreds. As the year ended, an Arrow Airlines DC-8 crashed and burned at Gander, Newfoundland, Canada. Killed were the flight crew and 248 U.S. soldiers. Hedley Gill heard the plane go down.
I did see the aircraft taxi out onto the runway, and all of a sudden I just heard this loud noise, and everything lit up at the end of the runway, and then I saw black smoke coming up.
As officials investigated, an airport source said the pilot had not asked to have the plane de-iced before takeoff. Authorities discounted sabotage theories. The deadliest crash ever took the lives of 520 people in August when a Japan Airlines plane lost control and slammed into a mountain. In June, all 329 people aboard an Air India jet perished when an explosion sent them plunging into the sea off the Irish coast. Authorities thought Sikh extremists planted bombs on the plane. The worst U.S. disaster was the Delta Airlines crash at Dallas-Fort Worth Airport that killed 133 people in August. Only the rear of the craft was not destroyed.
The only thing left that I could see from the freeway was the tail of the plane in a section of about five or six windows ahead of the tail. Totally charred.
Investigators blamed sudden erratic wind shifts they called wind shear. In February, a jet struck a TV transmitter in Bilbao, Spain, and exploded, killing all 148 people aboard. This is Barbara Campbell.
Concern over the spread of AIDS became an issue in the New York City school system. On the opening day of school, more than 10,000 youngsters in Queens elementary schools remained away from classes while their parents protested a decision by the New York City Board of Education. That controversial decision was to allow a 7-year-old second grader believed to be suffering from the deadly illness to attend school. Among the schools picketed by angry parents was Public School 90 in Richmond Hill, one of 63 schools affected by the boycott. Catherine Newman was one of the concerned parents.
Nobody's going to guarantee you that your child is not going to get it. I mean, they separate prisoners in jail, but yet they're willing to throw kids in school together. Doesn't make sense.
Other worried parents express similar feelings.
I feel we're protecting our rights as parents, as children. We raised our kids till they're 9, 7, whatever age. I'm not going to lose them now.
They're jeopardizing the welfare of all the children. For just a few.
The city is taking away our rights. Our rights to decide what's best for our children. And that's basically what the issue is here.
Two Queens school boards challenged that decision to allow the 7-year-old to attend classes and brought their case to court. It then developed that the child in question may not have AIDS at all, but that issue was not resolved. As for the outcome of the court case, that decision is still pending. This is Ed Cairns in New York.
By far the biggest thing the House did this year was to pass the Revolutionary Balanced Budget Amendment. Following the Senate's lead, the House sent the bill to the President's desk, calling for massive budget cuts and no budget deficit by 1991. House Majority Leader Jim Wright said those cuts will eventually hurt.
This bill's drastic. It's painful.
The House also approved a $10 billion extension of the Superfund bill. The money will be used to clean up hundreds of abandoned toxic waste dump sites around the country. Earlier, the House passed an emergency farm credit bill to bail out the farmer-owned farm credit system. It's tottering on the brink of default because farmers are hit by high production costs, low prices for their produce, and falling land values. Earlier this year, the House approved the massive farm bill. Cutting tobacco price supports and other produce programs farmers have become accustomed to leaning on. Agriculture panel chairman Kika De La Garza of Texas said such action hurts American farmers.
Why aren't we selling our crops abroad? Other people are raising crops, subsidized by their governments beyond what we are able to match.
The House moved toward protection of the textile industry by approving sanctions against Asian countries that dump large amounts of textiles on the U.S. market. Oregon's Les O'Coyne opposed the bill.
I don't think it's fair for the supporters of this bill to cost jobs in those sectors in order to try to provide some kind of protectionism for industries in their own districts and states.
One thing the House never did get to, immigration reform. Bonnier Bay, Capitol Hill.
The public first heard of John Walker in May, but by then he had already been passing U.S. military secrets to the Soviet Union for 2 decades. Accused of spying with him and facing prison terms are Walker's son Michael, brother Arthur, and friend Jerry Whitworth. John and Michael pleaded guilty and agreed to reveal all they had told the Soviets in exchange for a shorter sentence for the son. Prosecutor Michael Schatzow says the government needed that information but refused to lighten John Walker's sentence.
Because of his long history of espionage activities and the harm that he's done to the country from those, we were not willing to trade away anything in terms of his own sentencing. The only thing that left us was Michael.
John Walker could conceivably be released from prison in 10 years. Michael Walker has no chance for parole for 25 years. After the Walker arrests, authorities picked up one suspect after another in unrelated cases, accusing them of spying for countries including the Soviet Union, Israel, China, and Ghana. Espionage expert George Carver says there is more spying against the United States now than in past years.
Both our adversaries, such as the Soviet Union, and even apparently some of our allies, are actively trying to acquire U.S. technology, particularly technology that has a direct military application.
Carver says U.S. society discourages secrecy and rewards people like Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times. He says a country like that will have John Walkers. This is Barbara Campbell.
Wall Street, which usually reacts to news, became news in 1985, setting off one of the most meteoric rises in stock market history, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gaining over 300 points from the start of the year's trading. The reason? Declining interest rates that in turn revitalized the housing market and a good deal of American industry. Still the most important economic occurrence of the year, as seen by Chase Econometrics chief economist Larry Schimmerine, dealt with the dollar.
1985 was sort of a dull year for the economy with, you know, very slow growth and things working out pretty well as we expected. I would think the number one development was the G5 intervention agreement. The fact that the U.S. government began to realize how serious the trade problems have become and and how overvalued the dollar has been and is now beginning to take more steps to try to correct that. And that, to me, is an extremely important development.
As a result, the muscle-bound dollar, which had grown to Schwarzenegger proportions, was wilting fast under central bank intervention by year's end, promising a slowing of foreign imports and a much-needed rise in U.S. exports. On the political front, tax reform was stalling, but the Graham-Rudman bill balancing the federal budget by 1991 was passed. Texaco was busy wrangling with Pennzoil after being hit with the largest legal judgment in history, $11 billion for interfering with Pennzoil's takeover of Getty Oil. Overall, a so-so year for the average American who rolled up record debt in 85 but saw his income decline in real terms. On the plus side, housing and food became more affordable, with most economic predictions stating that that trend would continue throughout 1986. This is Mike Alabaugh.
The name of Konstantin Chernenko, an outstanding leader of the Communist Party and the Soviet state, a staunch fighter for the ideals of communism, for peace, will forever remain in the hearts of the Soviet people, of all of progressive mankind.
1985 was the year of change, the long overdue shift to a new generation of leadership in the Kremlin. The year opened with President Konstantin Chernenko missing from public view and sliding toward death. It ended with Mikhail Gorbachev firmly in control and projecting the image of the most forceful Soviet leader in decades. Gorbachev moved quickly to establish his hold. At the same time, state radio was announcing the death of Chernenko, and 4 hours before a successor was officially chosen, the news agency TASS was already translating Gorbachev's speech, accepting his promotion to General Secretary of the Communist Party. The confidence and vigor shown March 11th have remained his trademark. So far, he has shown more style than substance. And while few doubt his desire to shake the Soviet Union out of its stagnation, many doubt he will make the changes necessary to do it. That same uncertainty is apparent in foreign policy. He pounded out a hard line with the United States until his arrival in Geneva. But after 2 days of talks with President Reagan, Gorbachev is emphasizing a new beginning. He will probably have lots of time to work at it. This past year saw the start of a rule that is likely to last into the next century. Jack Redden, Moscow.
The sum total of the year in Lebanon is about 3,300 people dead. Not a high figure considering the destruction, the loss, and periods of mindless terror. But if Lebanon was the size of the United States, 2 million would have been killed. In a year of unprecedented terrorism across the Middle East, Beirut was at the eye of the storm, with kidnappings of more Americans and other Westerners and a string of hijackings, including a 17-day affair with a TWA jetliner. Hostage spokesman Alan Conwell could well have been speaking for the Lebanese when he said the 39 Americans felt like pawns caught in a tense war of nerves.
Retaliation sounds an awful lot like revenge. I don't seek any retaliation or revenge. I think all of the men here would like to see justice prevail.
It was also a spectacular year for bombings, with a succession of massive car bomb blasts, leaving hundreds dead and whole neighborhoods destroyed in both Beirut and Tripoli. 14 suicide bombers tried to force the last Israelis out of southern Lebanon. Politically, the country moved closer to Syria, which started calling most of the shots, but proved unable to arrange a lasting peace and unwilling to send Syrian troops into Beirut in case they became trapped like everyone else. Peter Smurden in Beirut.
At 8.1 on the Richter scale, the quake that hit Mexico that September morning was one of the biggest in recent years. Most damage was done in the central section of Mexico City, where hundreds of buildings collapsed, including a third of the city's hospitals, dozens of schools, and several large apartment buildings and hotels. Jim Gribner was visiting the city.
The floor was shaking, so we ran like 3 stories down onto the street, and the street was shaking. This hotel about a block away collapsed. It was about 10 stories high. And it caught on fire.
Between 6,000 and 8,000 people perished. Hundreds of buildings were left in ruin. Volunteers looked for survivors going through the debris. A large aftershock the next day, a huge quake in its own right, collapsed more buildings
and sent tens of thousands of people to live in the streets. In the days that followed, remarkable stories of survival unfolded. Babies pulled from a hospital maternity ward alive after a week in the rubble. Ruben Berra, a labor ministry worker, was pulled out after spending 4 days under tons of debris. He breathed trapped air and wet his lips with his own urine.
He started to shout, and they told him, I could help you. So he said it felt such a wonderful thing that people could help him. He's so thankful.
With many of the missing never to be found and tens of thousands still homeless, a UN survey estimated the economic damage to Mexico at $4 billion. This is Bob Fuss. January 28th, a new era in music fundraising began. It was an extraordinary collection of America's top musicians who recorded We Are the World to raise money for the starving people of Africa. Michael Jackson and Lionel Richie wrote the song and sang it with dozens of big-name stars like Cyndi Lauper, Willie Nelson, Bruce Springsteen, Stevie Wonder, and Bob Dylan. Quincy Jones produced the record, overseeing an extraordinary musical event.
Bruce Springsteen finished screaming his brains out and says, is that okay? You know, and Stevie's teaching Bobby Dylan his part at the piano.
5 million copies of the record have been sold, some $34 million raised to feed the hungry. The impetus for the record came from Britain. Bob Geldof sponsored an English version earlier, and he became the project's conscience.
Certainly this famine, which potentially will kill 100 million people, is one of the great shameful things of our time. And I find it an indictment of us and a pathetic way of living that a piece of plastic 7 inches across with a hole in the middle is the price of someone's life this year.
The success of We Are the World created a whole new branch of music. There were versions featuring gospel, country, and Latin singers. The Canadians had one, and the Australians. There was a concert called Live Aid. And then promoter Ken Cragen announced a new project for next year to raise money for the hungry in America, involving millions of Americans holding hands coast to coast. This is Bob Fuss. October 2nd, actor Rock Hudson dies after having shocked the country with the revelation he had AIDS. The last few months of Rock Hudson's life focused extraordinary attention on the dying actor and on the disease that killed him. He gave a dreaded illness a face. It was the face of an actor who got into movies because of his good looks. Acting skills came later. In the 1954 film Magnificent Obsession with Jane Wyman, they were displayed.
Would it be all right if I came by occasionally? Just for launching out boards and general morale purposes. I hope you won't think I'm imposing.
Well, of course not. We'll hope to see you again very soon.
Catapulted into one of Hollywood's top leading men, Hudson got an Academy Award nomination for Giant, then appeared in a series of successful bedroom comedies like Pillow Talk with Doris Day.
Eileen.
I do hate to interrupt, but would you mind hanging up, please? Who's that?
The other half of my party line. Just ignore her. She'll go away.
Hudson's last public appearance was with Doris Day in July. He looked gaunt and sick, the reason revealed when he checked into a hospital in Paris.
Mr. Rock Hudson has acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
When Hudson returned home, he'd become a symbol and a cause. Elizabeth Taylor organized a $1 million Hollywood AIDS fundraiser.
I think it really hit home, not just to the entertainment industry, but to all of America, because rock is a household word.
Hudson was 59 when he died 2 weeks after that fundraiser, remembered sadly less for the accomplishments of his life as for the cause of his death. Bob Fuss reporting.
In 1985, Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev joined countless other national leaders over the centuries who had gathered in Geneva to find a way to get along with each other without bloodshed. It had taken 5.5 years for Mr. Reagan to seek a summit, during which 3 Soviet leaders, Brezhnev, Andropov, and Chernenko, had been carried to their resting places inside the Kremlin wall. Mr. Reagan and Gorbachev were cautious in assessing their summit. Mr. Reagan saying it would take time to see results, but still...
I came to Geneva to seek a fresh start in relations between the United States and the Soviet Union, and we have done this.
Both men said there were still serious disagreements between the two sides, and Gorbachev spoke bluntly at a news conference about his concerns over Mr. Reagan's determination not to give up his space-based missile defense concept, the so-called Star Wars program.
And I tried to say to the president that since we felt that
he himself is so caught up with that idea. As a human being, as an individual, we could sort of understand him, but we could not understand that he as a political leader would adopt that position.
The summit produced little in terms of concrete results. What agreements were produced were expected, and in the major areas of arms control, human rights, regional conflicts, and so on, there was no agreement. They did decide, however, on a series of regular meetings between the U.S. Secretary of State and the Soviet Foreign Minister to discuss issues before they get out of hand. And they agreed to hold summits this coming year and in 1987. This year, General Secretary Gorbachev comes to America. I'm Bill Small at the White House.
For most South Africans, 1985 has been a year to forget, a year of bloodshed, false hopes, and missed opportunities. Violent black opposition to white minority rule goes on, with almost 800 people killed, most of them by police, in confrontations between officers and anti-apartheid demonstrators. The white government has promised a variety of reforms, but the only one implemented during the year was the abolition of bars on sex or marriage between whites and people of other races. The black uprising, by far the worst in 37 years of unbroken Afrikaner National Party rule, led President Pieter Botha to declare a state of emergency in July. More than 6,500 people were detained without trial under emergency powers. Reporters were barred from riot-torn townships, but the rate of killings doubled and there is still no sign of an end to the black violence. For a week in August, the world held its breath amidst rumors that Botha planned to announce major changes in the apartheid policy of institutionalized race discrimination. Instead, he renewed his vague commitment to a universal franchise in a united South Africa, while warning at the same time that one man, one vote would be tantamount to white suicide. Disappointed Western nations, including the United States, quickly responded with sanctions ranging from an American ban on the import of Krugerrand gold coins to European clamps on bank loans and technology exports. Hopes flared twice that jailed African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela would be released from his life sentence. Both times they were dashed by uncompromising white leaders in Pretoria. The chance of an accommodation between South Africa's black and white communities seems more remote than ever, and the new year promises little but further bloodshed. Brendan Boyle in Johannesburg.
4 years ago, Britain got its first modern taste of urban rioting. That was followed by the Scarman Report, which urged a series of reforms aimed at improving the lives of those caught in the decaying inner-city areas, mostly blacks who suffer bad housing, chronic unemployment, and they claim police harassment. Although the main recommendations of the Scarman Report were never implemented, some cosmetic changes were made, and everyone thought the problem had gone away. But when two men were arrested during an argument about a traffic violation in Birmingham this September, simmering resentment boiled over into full-blooded rioting. As buildings in Birmingham blazed, this warning was handed out by community leader Harold Reeve.
If urgent and constructive negotiations are not undertaken by the people who occupy positions of power to deal with the manifestations of racism within the society as a whole, and particularly in areas that have large concentrations of black people, then incidents of this kind will become commonplace.
And that proved correct as rioting spread to Liverpool and London. While community leaders blamed the police and the government for this summer's outbreak of violence, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher put the ball straight back in their court.
We shall need all the leaders in the local community to say, look, this should not have happened, utterly to condemn it, and to make certain that it doesn't happen again.
A fragile calm has once again returned to Britain's inner cities, but the problems are still there, and the far-reaching Scarman Report continues to gather dust on the government's bookshelves. Mike Miller, London.
This is Carol Brooks. It's the biggest selling record of all time, but Band-Aid mastermind Bob Geldof didn't stop there. The Live Aid concert sparked a whole new mass incentive to aid Africa's starving. It was 16 hours of live music, which featured 74 acts. It was staged in both London and Philadelphia, and it raised over $50 million. The London half featured top pop stars such as The Who, Elton John, Phil Collins, Paul McCartney, and many more. Ginny Cassola was in Philadelphia for the American half.
90,000 voices joined in to sing We Are the World with the entertainers on stage at JFK Stadium in Philadelphia as the American Live Aid concert drew to a close. Concertgoers in Philadelphia braved sweltering heat as they watched many of the most popular stars of the music world. Ken Cragen, one of the organizers, says it wasn't just a fundraiser with music.
The key is the education. The key is people getting involved. The key is people knowing that if they get involved, they can make a difference.
On the road again.
In August, country music star Willie Nelson approached Illinois Governor Jim Thompson at the State Fair in Springfield about a benefit concert for American farmers. The governor thought it was a good idea, and the University of Illinois football stadium was made available for Farm Aid. Nelson said the purpose of the concert was to heighten the public's awareness of the nation's farm crisis. For Carol Brooks in London, this is Ginny Casola in Chicago.
Just when vacationers felt safe traveling by ship, the Italian luxury liner Achille Lauro was hijacked by Palestinians in mid-October. At first, Yasser Arafat denied the captors were members of the PLO.
We are trying to find the link from where and to whom they are belong.
Despite Arafat's claim, when the ship anchored off Egypt's Port Said, PLO member Mohammed Abbas helped negotiate an end to the hijacking and was later accused of masterminding the attack. Relief for the apparent peaceful conclusion to the takeover was quickly replaced by outrage over the cold-blooded murder of the elderly American passenger, Leon Klinghoffer. And when Washington discovered Egypt was flying Abbas and the hijackers to freedom in Tunis, President Reagan ordered the plane intercepted and forced to land in Italy. On November 24th, air travelers were the victims once again, with the hijacking of an Egyptian passenger jet en route from Athens to Cairo. The plane landed in Malta, and when the hijackers began shooting passengers with each passing hour, Egyptian commandos were brought in to storm the plane. It was a tragic end to a terrible ordeal, with 60 passengers dying in the crossfire between the soldiers and the hijackers. Australian passenger Anthony Lyons described what happened.
A lot of people were being shot on the tarmac because the Egyptian commandos didn't know who was a terrorist and who wasn't.
Since the shootout, there has been an international debate about the use of force to end a hijacking. But the only conclusion all seem agreed upon is the need to tighten security at the world's airports. This is Giselle McAuliffe.
America held hostage. It all sounded familiar, but this time it was Beirut, not Iran. And this time it was an airliner, not an embassy. On June 14th, TWA Flight 847 took off from Athens, bound for Rome, when two passengers armed with guns and hand grenades ordered the pilot to fly to Beirut. The nightmare didn't end until 17 days later. The plane zigzagged back and forth between Beirut and Algiers, and several of the 153 people on board were let go in different groups. The hijackers were demanding that over 700 Shiite Muslim prisoners be released from Israeli jails. U.S. Navy diver Robert Steedham was the victim of their threat to execute the hostages. He was beaten, shot in the head, and his body was thrown onto the tarmac at Beirut Airport. President Reagan vowed not to give in to the hijackers.
To do so would only invite more terrorism. Nor will we ask nor pressure any other government to do so.
The situation also sparked one of the biggest media wars ever. The hijackers were calling all of the information shots, and they chose an ABC crew to interview Captain John Testrake, the pilot of the plane. Testrake called on the Reagan administration not to try and rescue the hostages by force. He spoke with a gun held to his head.
I think that we'd all be dead men if they did, because we're continually surrounded by many guards.
In the days that followed, there was a lot more confusion, but finally, on June 30th, the remaining 39 hostages were set free. But the Reagan administration is still faced with the problem of how to obtain the safe release of six other Americans who are still being held hostage in Lebanon. This is Carol Brooks.
1985 was a turning point for NASA and its often criticized shuttle program. The space agency turned adversity into opportunity, doubling its flight rate to launch 15 commercial and military satellites and to repair another. In April, the SINCOM satellite failed to activate after its deployment, and a hastily devised rescue attempt was unsuccessful. But in late August, two spacewalking astronauts revisited SINCOM and hot-wired it back to life.
Omni, deploy, fire.
Omni, fire. Here she comes. Looking good. Looking good, buddy. All right. Dog, look at that, Jack.
If SINCOM was the high point of the year for NASA, the Space Lab mission in July was the most difficult. An engine shutdown on the launch pad July 12th forced a 17-day postponement. Then on July 29th, en route to orbit, one of Challenger's engines suddenly quit.
We have a center engine down.
Abort ATO. Abort ATO.
Mission Control, Houston, we have a center engine down on the Challenger.
Challenger survived the so-called abort to orbit, and its mission was a success. At year's end, NASA's administrator took a leave of absence after being indicted by a federal grand jury for alleged activities related to his previous job with General Dynamics. But that did not diminish NASA's enthusiasm in looking forward to 1986, a year in which a teacher and a journalist will fly in space for the first time, a year in which Halley's Comet will be observed by both man and machine, a year in which the powerful space telescope will be launched to enable man to see out into the universe, to the fringes of the origin of life itself. Rob Nabius at the Kennedy Space Center.